Greetings, and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the podcast whose only Christmas wish this year is for more time to get through our endless RPG backlogs. I'm your host, David Lloyd, and for this episode, our panelists went through hell and high water to play the final console game from Hironobu Sakaguchi, the aptly named The Last Story. But before we get into our discussion, I just wanted to ask that if you do end up enjoying the episode, please consider leaving us a review on your podcast player of choice. It helps grow the show and provides feedback to ensure we're providing the best possible experience. But from here, let's introduce who's on tonight's panel. Starting with the man who may have played his last Wii game if he has anything to say about it, NWR Reviews editor, Jordan Rudick.
I know I put my Wii away for a reason, and then of course the Wii U just keeps the Wii with you as long as you've got that 2-in-1 console. Like I like that the Wii U can play Wii games, but yeah, I'm starting to remember why this generation I spent a lot of time playing PS3 and Xbox 360 instead of Wii.
And also joining us is a gentleman who may no longer be welcome at his local retailer due to the pyramid scheme that he required to get his Wii U working in time for this episode, Radio Free Nintendo co-host Guillaume Vaillette.
If you want that story, listen to, RFN episodes, Radio Free Nintendo episodes, 647, 648, I think, maybe 649. But, that was an ordeal, but I've got a working Wii now, or Wiimote in my Wii U, and it's kind of great. I guess I'm the opposite of Jordan here. I'm actually kind of rediscovering everything that was great about the Wii, and everything that was not so great. I'm just glad that it freaking works now.
I like to think of it as a monkey's paw. Well, Guillaume, do you want to kick us off with your drink for the night?
Sure. So, I decided for this episode to drink something that comes from where I come from. And it's kind of funny because I just got it at the local grocery store in Montreal. It's very far away from where I grew up. And so I guess that this microbrewery that's from, and I almost don't want to say the name of the town, not because I think that people will dox me, but because I remember in college, some roommates found it incredibly funny, the name of the town. What do you think that Titus is called in French?
Titus from Final Fantasy X?
No, Titus, like T-I-T-U-S.
Oh, okay. How to pronounce that in French, you mean? Okay.
Yeah, so I went to school, to high school, in a town called Saint-Tit, which, yeah, I don't know.
I follow where you're going here. I won't say it, but I think I know what it would be.
Yeah. So this is I'm drinking a red beer from À l'Affût, which is kind of a play on words. I won't explain, but it's from basically the next town over where I grew up, and it's pretty good. It's a beer.
Was the microbrewery, was it there when you were growing up, or that it's there now?
No.
I guess microbreweries weren't that that big back then, right?
Yeah, I don't know who started it or what, but yeah, it would be maybe like someone from my generation who decided to start a business there. So, sure. And it's pretty decent. And yeah, like microbreweries when I grew up were not really much of a thing, and now they're everywhere, of course.
Yeah, so. They're pretty recent phenomenon, really. Like there's a bunch popping up here in Ottawa now too, all the time. It seems like every. All the time you're hearing about, I got a buddy of mine who's into the scene, and he keeps telling me about all these ones popping up in Ottawa, so.
What's funny is that you can, like, they've got also, like, a bar where you can have, like, you know, like, fries and whatever, and you can get a steak frite, the Veillette steak frite, which has nothing to do with me, but it bears my name, and that's pretty cool.
Have you had the Veillette steak frite, Guy? How is it?
I don't eat steak, okay. So I That's haven't, right, yeah. But the fries were pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for me, I should be drinking because I wasn't a huge fan of the game we're going to talk about. Some parts I like, but I'm back to my familiar cold weather drink, which is my vegan hot chocolate that I like. But the difference now is I don't know why I started thinking about it, but I was craving those kind of tiny, dehydrated marshmallows that you find in, like, a 7-Eleven would have them that you could just add to your drink. They'd be, like, in a little canister. Or you'd buy instant hot chocolate either in the pouch form or in the can, and you'd get the little marshmallows in it. I guess I was thinking about this because we were buying some cereals that had marshmallows. So I was thinking, oh, okay, I want the marshmallows in my hot chocolate. So I found it on Amazon, and there's not that many. I don't think it's that easy to get a thing of dehydrated marshmallows, but I ended up finding one on Amazon. And when I ordered it, they didn't have a date. It didn't have a date when they would be shipping it by. They didn't know what the date would be. So I thought, okay, maybe this might not come for a few months, but it ended up coming this week. So I've got my hot chocolates, my little marshmallows in here, and it makes me feel like I'm drinking a more real is the wrong word, but a hot chocolate that reminds me of the ones I used to have when I was before I became lactose intolerant. So I'm very happy with my vegan hot chocolate with my little marshmallows in it, even though they kind of melt pretty fast, but that's okay.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's a good winter drink.
Mm-hmm. David,
I went very similar to Guillaume. I had a red ale as well. It's a quadruple Abbey from Mons. So this is a strong Belgian ale. It's actually new from them. They have a line of beers that I enjoy. I love their double Abbey, the double amber. So I thought, well, quadruple's got to be twice as good. So I had it, and it is wonderful. I don't know if I like it more than the double, but it's got a very strong taste to it, which I enjoy, and I'm pretty happy that they have it, and hopefully it sticks around.
I'm just happy to see you above 10% alcohol content again. You've got 10.5% written down in the notes here, so that I think that's back to normal for you.
Yep, it's the standard I have to. Double digits is definitely a must these days. So
anytime we play a Wii game in the future, it's got to be 10% or above.
That's right. I don't know how I can go back now. It's ingrained in me. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, as we've been alluding to, we all decided to play The Last Story on the Nintendo Wii. So this is a Sakaguchi-developed RPG for the Nintendo Wii, released in January of 2011 in Japan and in August of 2012 in North America. And we'll have a little bit more on that later. But it was developed by Sakaguchi's company Mistwalker. Mistwalker created back in 2004. Which was at the time funded by Microsoft because they wanted him to make some games for the Xbox 360. So the first couple games that he did make for them was Blue Dragon and Lost Odyssey. And a third game was slated to be built. It was called The Cry On, but unfortunately was canceled. It was kind of the old PR speak where they said market forecasts and current environment and all that stuff. But if recollection proceeds, then I believe Blue Dragon and Lost Odyssey didn't sell the greatest, and I'm thinking that's probably why the third one ended up not going through.
Yeah, you got to remember, this is when Microsoft was trying to court Japan. They wanted to penetrate the Japanese market, and they must have sold in the single digits week after week, number, you know, like 10 Xboxes or whatever. Like, you know, it was a it did not sell well, and surely that did not do Japanese developers any favors. Yeah, I can't imagine that Blue Dragon and what is it? Last Odyssey?
Lost Odyssey.
Yeah, I can't imagine that they sold very well. So
they're very Japanese games, right? Like you're creating Xbox 360 exclusives. I get that you want to penetrate that market, but most of your customers are in the West, and I think that's one of the reasons they didn't sell that well. I think they're good games, actually. So it's kind of a shame.
Right.
Yeah, I haven't played either, but they're on my list. I need to pick them up, and one day in the future.
The nice thing, you can probably, if you look closely, Dave, you can probably get them really, really cheap on the Microsoft Store. I don't know if you can play them on PC, maybe, but I probably picked up both games for under $10. Like they were, Lost Odyssey was like $1 or $2 at one point for a couple of years ago, I think. Yeah.
So I know what I'm doing after this show then.
Yeah. There you go.
Exactly. So then in 2008, Sakaguchi ended up with Mistwalker coming back to Nintendo, and they did a trio of Blue Dragon titles for the Nintendo DS. And that relationship blossomed into Nintendo bankrolling the last story. So it took from what we were told by Sakaguchi, it took about 3 years for them to develop it. The first year was devoted to the battle system, them trying to perfect it. And then they spent the next 2 years redoing the entire story because Nintendo thumbs downed their initial pitch. They were, I guess Sakaguchi was going for a more futuristic setting, and they had some ideas that they had, and Nintendo said, nope, thanks, try again. And they had to rebuild the whole thing from the ground up. So they got it done, and 2011 is when it came out in Japan. And then Guillaume was, it's funny, Guillaume was telling me this week, I've never heard of this before, but Operation Rainfall is could be the reason, or probably is the reason, or is the reason that we got the game in North America. And as soon as I saw where it originated, I knew that Guillaume was probably involved or at least knew about this. So maybe if you want to tell us about it.
No, I was not involved, but I guess
Guillaume
I saw
is
it
Operation
happen.
Rainfall.
No, I'm not. And we'll get into why that's a good thing. But I guess I saw it evolve in real time, more or less, but I didn't participate myself. But yeah, like someone on the IGN message boards was like, let's start this movement. Like, let's try to convince Reggie Fils-Aimé to bring Xenoblade, but also The Last Story and also Pandora's Tower. These Japanese games that have been published by Nintendo in Japan, but seem to be stuck over there. So we're gonna write letters, and we're gonna try to convince Nintendo of America to do something about them. And Nintendo of America seemed to be very reticent. There were things going on, like Nintendo of Europe ended up localizing Xenoblade Chronicles, right? And they wanted to show what they had done. They wanted to show the English version at E3 2011, I think. Or anyway, I might not have the date right, but if you check Wikipedia, you'll get the right info. And yeah, like Nintendo of America refused, and it just really made it look like Nintendo of America had no intention of ever publishing these games that Nintendo had published in Japan. So, Operation Rainfall went underway, and about, I guess, like 18 months, like several months after Europe got both Xenoblade Chronicles and The Last Story. So Nintendo of America did end up publishing Xenoblade, but Exceed are the one that ended up publishing The Last Story in North America. And that's kind of interesting. They also picked up Pandora's Tower, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that.
So yeah, so I don't know. Like, I think it created this... of course, like, we'll never get a straight answer, but Reggie Fils-Aimé is the guy who famously said that they weren't going to publish Disaster Day of Crisis because it was a bad game. I think that he lost a little bit of his luster with Nintendo fans on that day, because people wanted to play the latest Monolith Soft game, and then Xenoblade didn't seem to be coming, and so people got really upset, and eventually we ended up getting all these games, and that's a good thing. Personally, my favorite is Pandora's Tower, but Xenoblade, I hear, has been pretty popular. Mm-hmm. And The Last Story also. Some people like it.
we'll find out who those people are very soon, I think.
Yeah. So Operation Rainfall, one thing I'm glad I did not get involved with it is because they ended up being, they created their own website, and they're still going on apparently to this day, still reviewing or whatever. And when Gamergate happened, they were very much... on the against games journalist side or whatever it is, and they kind of bought into the whole Gamergate thing. So that was kind of sad to see. And usually when you see a controversy, quote unquote, about games being localized, i.e. like, oh, it's been censored, they're on the side that thinks that it's censorship, and our views don't align. I'm not a huge fan.
That's too bad. You never want to give in to mob mentality, but at least, I mean, it's good
for people.
At least
they'll stoke the fires and, yeah.
Yeah, at least get people, I'm like, hopefully at the time at least, maybe it was a little nicer, but just the fans kind of drumming up support for their game, like to show that they wanted that sort of thing. It's unfortunate it went anything past that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like it seemed like a positive thing. It seemed wholesome, but then it turned into something else.
Yeah. Well, it's that whole you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Is that the...
That, or sure. if what happens when you get your way, you get you feel like you have all this power and you use it for
drunk
evil afterwards, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a couple of interesting things that kind of connect to this discussion, I think. And one is that Xenoblade, despite all this time it took for to be localized in the West, it's become one of Nintendo's like tentpole RPG series, if not the tentpole RPG series. And next year, you know, kind of right on topic here, we're getting the remake of or the in, you know,
right, definitive edition.
Definitive edition, yeah. Enhanced remaster. I don't know whatever the hell we want to call it, but we're getting another version of the original Xenoblade Chronicles on Switch. So that's a total of about five Xenoblade Chronicles games in the series now. And this has all happened in less than a decade. And it's just funny to see that after all the pushback there was, or all the maybe hesitating to bring the game over to the West in the first place, and now it's a huge franchise for you. So I've always thought that's kind of interesting, right?
I kind of think that maybe this is tied to Nintendo's fortunes, like these games came out towards the end of the Wii, and I think that Nintendo of America was thinking, well, we don't really need to cater to the Nintendo hardcore, quote unquote, you know, the fans who will buy every Mario game and every Metroid game. Like we've got this blue ocean now. We've got the people who buy Wii Fit and Wii Sports, and we're gonna cater to everyone, not just to our fan base. And then the Wii U came out, and only a subset of that fan base even picked it up. And so I think that probably convinced Nintendo to greenlight some games that would cater to those people. And there didn't seem to be, like, it, you know, Apple seemed to take away all that blue ocean that Nintendo was courting before with the iPad and the iPhone. And so, yeah, basically they had to fall back on us. And that probably helped Monolith Soft's prospects within that company.
I don't know if a very, very small thing. I don't know if you guys know the answer to this or if there is an answer. But if you remember, the Wii U, they on the eShop, they released a few of the full-priced Wii games full AAA Wii games. And we got Xenoblade Chronicles, Pandora's Tower, Metroid Prime Trilogy, a few others. But for some reason, the last story never came. And I think these games were priced at about $20, like, you know, pretty reasonable. And I was always disappointed that the last story was the one of the three games that didn't make its way to the Wii U eShop. I thought that was kind of funny. David, I don't know if you know, or Guy, if you heard any reason why that might be. Is it tied into licensing or something like that, maybe?
I don't know. You said Pandora's Tower was one of them?
It is one of them, yep. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because
It came later, I think, but
if it was an XSEED thing where XSEED just didn't want to bother or something, but I know they did Pandora's Tower, so I'm not sure why they wouldn't have done
Last Story.
Yeah,
that's why it's weird that the last story wasn't brought over. I'm wondering if it's where it's tied up or they just didn't want to. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have the answer.
That's strange. Like, I can't think of any. I don't feel like there was anything licensing-wise, like outside
there's
of XSEED.
There's literally nowhere else to play the last story. Like, you have to have a physical Wii disc to play this game. It's not available digital anywhere. So whereas Xenoblade Chronicles, Pandora's Tower, there are digital versions of these games now. But yeah, it's just funny that's the one that last story is the one that got left behind, I guess.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of is if maybe they needed Mistwalker to do some kind of coding to switch it to digital or something. And I know, I think by 2012, I think he was already working on like iOS stuff. So maybe it just moved on.
Far too busy with their mobile games to bring the last story digitally.
Yeah. So did you guys want, maybe did you guys each want to do just a quick rundown of what you thought of the last story, just kind of a general feeling that you got from each game? If Guy, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. So I tried. I bought this game not when it came out, but maybe like the first time that I saw it on sale at retail. Like it was. I think it came out at $50, like a full or 40 in the US, like a full $10 less than a full price retail release originally. And even then, like I think I was I had enough games on my plate that I could afford to just wait on it. So I waited for a sale, I picked it up. I played 3 hours of it. Like I went back to, because I still had my save file, when I tried to play this year, and yeah, it was like between 2 and 3 hours into it. And I had put it down, and I never came back to it again until now. And when I saw that, I was like, well, that's weird. Like, why didn't I never finish this? Why didn't I never get further than this? It's generally well regarded. And then I played past the first kind of dungeon, you know, the little like tutorial area, and I got to the town where initially it's kind of overwhelming, and it's like it's really weird. It has you do like weird stuff that you're not that I'm not used to in an RPG. Like all of a sudden, like you have to use like an aiming reticle to look for stuff on the ground, and like you have to do that really quickly to get some items. You have to fight in this arena and to be able to grind for money and for experience. And every time you go through that same arena, it's always the same battle, but just slightly higher level enemies. But mostly what put me off was Seren and Lowell. Like immediately the game kind of pairs you with these two, and I think that they're the two worst characters in the game, like, or at least initially. Like they're very, very obnoxious. They're the kind of friends that always kind of try to peer pressure you into doing things that you don't want, or that are always teasing you. And I don't really like that dynamic. Like I don't hang out with people like that. Like I and so like you know like Saren is downright like alcoholic. She's always drinking, always talking about drinking. And Lowell is what's the word?
Oh, womanizer.
A late womanizer. Yeah, so he's always constantly talking about picking
Conquests.
up some wench, or you know, like, and sometimes that's the kind of language that sometimes they use in this game. And so yeah, very unpleasant. And I remembered, oh yeah, that's why I put it down. I don't like these people at all. So I got past that point, obviously, this time. I finished the game. And I think that the first bit, like the first third, is pretty rocky because the game starts off pretty slow. The combat is very simplistic. They don't give you all the options initially. The characters, as I said, don't really shine initially. And yeah, it's kind of rough. And I kind of saw a succession of tropes, fantasy tropes, that I did not really care for because I don't even really care that much about fantasy settings in general. This game is very Lord of the Rings flavored, like Western RPG flavored, or at least that's the kind of vibe that it seems to be trying to go for. I was really not that impressed. I don't know if we're going to deal, like we're going to break it down into categories later, but I'm just going to say that right now. The initial training area has you go through the Mines of Moria, literally, like from the Lord of the Rings movie. Like these giant stone columns are straight out of that movie. Like the inspiration is very clear. And if it wasn't clear enough, in that very same area, at some point you cross a stone bridge, and there's like a giant monster thing that could be a Balrog, but you know it's not. But it's got a serial number filed off. But yeah, like it plays out exactly like in that movie, or almost. So I was just like, holy crap, someone watched Lord of the Rings and put that in their game. And it's not exactly, you know, it's not exactly the first time that's happened, or it's not the first the first Japanese developer who never sinned cast a first stone. I don't know what's the expression, but like Nintendo did that themselves with like Twilight Princess, right? Like there was they when they showed some of the early trailers, like were kind of grimdark. Like they had the music of Conan the Barbarian playing, and they showed Link facing off against giant enemies wielding like chains around, very much trying to evoke that Lord of the Rings movie feeling. So, but yeah, I did not really. While I like those movies, I do not really generally care for fantasy settings like that. So
yeah, let's see. I suppose I went into this game expecting something that I didn't get at all, but also not really knowing much about it either. Like I don't think I really saw a lot of screenshots or watched videos or anything. I went into it pretty blind and just kind of assumed it was a more standard JRPG, maybe with some type of turn-based battle system, or you know, standard progression mechanics, and the type of world I might expect from Sakaguchi. I was thinking back to something like The Lost Odyssey, because that was same console generation. Again, highly regarded, just as the last story is. But yeah, I didn't get that from the early on. Even from the tutorial, I was thinking to myself, like, I don't like this battle system. I don't like the way it's going to go. We'll talk about the battle mechanics in a little bit. The game is so condensed into these specific areas, and you spend so much time in them that I think the game feels very, very small. The chapter system, I think, doesn't work really well, because the chapters are all very, very different lengths. Like, one chapter might take you an hour, and another one might be a 5-minute cutscene, and then it's done. So it's very hard to kind of grasp, I guess, where you are in the story, or maybe it disrupts the flow of the narrative or something like that. Like, imagine reading a novel, and a chapter is 2 pages and the next one's 40 pages. Like, if you keep alternating like that, or kind of throwing in different lengths, different numbers, it doesn't really work out as a story, I don't think. Or at least you have to do it in a purposeful and meaningful way, and I don't think the last story does. I don't hate the game. I don't think it's a bad game. I think it's aged poorly. I think maybe Wii games in general, the visual style has aged very poorly. It's very striking when you first see this game, the art style, and just and David was mentioning it to me earlier about the kind of the browns and the earth tones, and you see them everywhere, and the colors just seem very muted. You don't really go many places in this game and think, oh, this is really beautiful. There's a couple outdoor areas maybe that come to mind, but there's not much. Most of the time you spend in the town, which I think is very drab looking. I don't think it's an interesting area to explore. And I think that the lack of maybe enticing visuals doesn't push you, at least didn't push me, to do much of the side content. And there is a fair bit of optional side quests and things you can do. A fair bit of it I ignored. Like, you can do shopkeeping stuff with Zale. There's just a ton of stuff. Guy, you mentioned kind of using the reticle and looking around the town and picking up items and meeting people like that. And there's a lot of that stuff in the town you can do. I didn't really do anything of like that. You can return to previous areas and do different quests there. And I don't find a lot to compel you to do that in this game. It's kind of just, it's there, I suppose it's there if you want to, or maybe during a New Game Plus run you could do that stuff. But yeah, I think my overall impression of the last story is that it wasn't what I wanted it to be. I didn't know what exactly it was going to be, but I still came away disappointed by what the final product is. And there's a couple of highlights closer to the end of the game, like the last third or so, but I think there's a lot of plotting before you get there, and yeah, we'll get into some more specifics soon. What about you, David?
Yeah, I actually had forgotten this game existed until you guys brought it up, so I had to track down a copy on eBay, well, which wasn't too difficult, but like you were saying before, I was kind of shocked that the only way to play this was to find a disc, so that was a little disappointing, but once I got it, it was fine. My feelings, I guess, are a little bit mixed, because I kind of have a bit of share the same feelings with both of you, in a sense where at the beginning of the game, I was kind of turned off. Like, there was it was pretty grating, the Seren and Lowell, the way they were acting at the beginning. It just seemed that the characters were one dimensional. Like, they didn't seem like they had a lot of depth to them up at the beginning. As Guy had mentioned, the combat mechanics weren't very detailed at that point. It wasn't overly complex. As things went on, as the battle mechanics opened up, I started to enjoy it more. I guess the problem I had was that every time I felt like I was kind of getting into the groove, that what would end up happening is that something would just drag on a little too long, or they put you in an area that you've already been in before, or you'd fight an enemy that you've already fought before, and it felt like every time the game got momentum, something would slow it down a bit. And it went through that a few different times throughout the game where I felt like, okay, it's starting to get a groove, and then something funny happens, and then it's like, oh, man. And it just kind of takes a little bit of the wind out of my sails. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm still happy that I played it. It was still a fun game to an extent. So I have no regrets. And happy to go through it. And especially since this seems to be Sakaguchi's last console game, the way things are going. So it's happy to have picked that up. So. So maybe to just start off getting into the details of the last story, maybe I'll start with asking you guys, how did you end up playing? Because I know that, like, for me, I used the Wii Classic controller because I cannot stand the Wii remote. Did both of you use the Classic controller as well? Or?
Yeah, I got the Classic controller Pro. I used that. Sometimes I kind of regretted it. I kind of wonder if the whole reticle thing would have worked better, actually, with the pointer. But it was infrequent enough that the solution to that was just not do the reticle thing all that often, and that was good. Yeah, it's but I don't know, like, in general, I don't mind Wii controls all that much, but this seemed to be a game that, yeah, you wanted to play with the Classic controller, just like Xenoblade.
Yeah, it just seemed like the reticle things weren't even really necessary. They almost seemed like they were put in just for the sake of being in. Because most of the time, yeah, what would happen is you'd kind of walk into an area and then it would be like, look around, and you'd like look for the trigger, basically, for the cutscene. Mm-hmm. I think like 75% of the time I used the pointer was just to be like, okay, I need to look at the thing you want me to look at so that the cutscene can start.
Yeah, I mean, so that's absolutely the case. Like it was built around the Wii, and it made use of that gimmick, and oh man, it doesn't work. I don't think it works well at all. Like I think it detracts from the game.
It just seemed redundant.
Oh, for sure. Like you could easily highlight those things with a cursor. Doing so with a cursor is annoying. Like, it's not a fun thing to do. It might be, you might be right. Like I was thinking of that too, that maybe playing some of the parts with the pointer or actually using the Wii remote that way probably would have been more fun. Like, I think using Zale's crossbow, actually aiming with the pointer and using the crossbow that way, not only would it work better, I think it'd be more fun. But I don't even have a what the hell is that, the thing you need for the Wii to activate the pointer?
The nunchuck?
No, the sensor bar. I don't have a sensor bar, so I was kind of stuck using the Classic controller Pro. I used a Pro as well. I had to use that anyways. But I've never liked the gimmicks of the Wii. Like, Wii Sports was fine, but I didn't like them in non-Wii Sports games. So I think they're very cumbersome here.
I actually liked the pointer back in the Wii days. It's probably my favorite feature of the Wii, but now I've got a bigger TV. I'm sitting a little bit further away, so the pointer is not really that reliable anymore, or not as much as it used to, just because I'm sitting too far. But also, yeah, it's just not that well implemented. Like, you can kind of see what they were going for. But sometimes it just ends up being silly, you know, like there's this whole scene where you're about to get your knighthood spoilers, and the one of the main knight guys is like, okay, present this to the count. And so now you have to look at what he's holding in his hands. So you get the first person view of his, of Zale. And he's looking at the dude at his face, and you have to look down, and he's holding a sword. And okay, congratulations. You successfully press down to look at the sword.
I mean, that's 10 out so of 10 kind of... gameplay. That's the kind of gameplay you want from your RPGs, you know?
But sometimes, like, I thought, that's kind of a, maybe it's a little bit clever. Like, the whole sequence on the boat, the not the boat, but the crashed boat with the ghost. Anyway, like, there's a point where the game asks you to look for the way down, and you have to go and look and point at the ladder. And I thought, like, well, I guess maybe that's a solution for people who get confused or turn around in a 3D environment. Like, just have the game pause and have them actually look for the ladder. And now you see, okay, there's a ladder. There's an exit here. And that's where I need to go. But yeah, that's kind of a stretch. Yeah. Because, I mean, like, eventually, like, someone would just be able to, like, press A, like, hugging the wall everywhere and get out of that that room anyway, find the ladder just almost by accident. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, it reminded me of Metroid Other M, which had these kind of, you know, find the pixel scene segments where it asks you to point at something, like, to find the thing that they wanted you to find, but... The ones in Metroid Other M were a lot tougher. In this game, it's like they don't even have the conviction of letting you search for a while. Because after like 3 seconds, it actually points you towards where you're supposed to look.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's weird.
Yeah. Well, I thought the battle mechanics themselves that Sakaguchi and company took a year to develop, I thought on the most part were pretty decent. So the way that it works is you're in third person controlling Zale most of the time. There are a few instances where you end up controlling someone else. But the basic mechanics are that you run around with the left stick. The melee attacks are automatic, so you just have to be within a certain distance of the enemy for it to trigger Zale to slash at the enemy. You use the A button to do like jumps. You can hide behind items, like if they're like the aforementioned pillars of rock, you can hide behind them, and there's different attacks that you eventually, like you said, you don't get them all up front. You end up earning not even earning them. There's certain points where it's just given to you where, okay, you need to do this thing now. Now you have this attack. So I believe at the beginning it starts with there's a slash that you can do from behind. You hide behind the pillar or hide behind something, and you can, when the enemy comes close enough, you can do a slashing move. You'll jump over, jump out, and do a slash. My favorite was later on in the game, I think about halfway through or so, you can do a wall run where you'll run up the wall. I guess the game doesn't really pause, but your person pauses in midair, and you can choose where to land to do the slash. I found myself doing that quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a fun move.
Yep. And one of the uses for the reticle, though, is that Zale has a crossbow. I found aiming, I guess that's the thing, is if I had the Wii remote, it probably would have been easier to aim, because
for sure
I really didn't use the crossbow all that much, just because I felt that the aiming, it took too long to aim it where I wanted it to go. So I guess that's one of the downsides of using the classic controller. So I used it a little bit, but not a whole lot. But that's the general action RPG battle mechanics that they have. Guy had actually, and it's funny, for the downside of it, Guy had mentioned there's a lot of places where it's narrow or there's not a lot of room. And the auto attack kind of got grated on my nerves in a few cases where there was a lot of enemies, because it felt like the auto attack would just go and I actually couldn't do the things I wanted, or I would try to move, or I'd just be like crushed against the wall or something, and the camera would be going haywire, and I would try to do is leap out to try to center myself again.
Yeah, I know, like, because this game, I guess, was also, you know, like, we've all been using the classic controller, but it was designed for a controller that had fewer buttons. So everything is assigned to the A button. Like, the regular attack is just kind of automatic. You just point towards the enemy and you attack, right? But A is kind of the roll dodge move. It's also, if you hold it down, it does trigger like kind of a swirl thing, like a special attack. But it's also how you open a chest, which has happened to me during a fight. Like, I didn't even know there was a chest at my feet. And so I press A, and it's like, okay, Zell, I guess we're doing this now. You're gonna pick up what's in that chest while orcs or whatever are fighting around you. But yeah, like, it's extremely kind of cumbersome because you wish that at least the dodge roll would be mapped to something else, because there were, yeah, as you said, like, there were times when, like, pressed against a wall trying to escape from an enemy, but as you try to escape, you just end up slashing at another enemy that's there, or at that enemy. Like, the sometimes, like, even though you're going right and the enemy is in front of you, you're still slashing at it because I guess the detection, like, he's too close, so you can't get away. Yeah, anyway, it was frustrating at times, but when the areas were open, it worked pretty well. One thing about the combat, so yeah, like, I think that they doled out the new moves a little bit too slowly, and the initial moves that you get are a little bit stupid. like the slash move that you mentioned when you're hiding behind a column and then you kind of come out, and when the enemies have this question mark above their heads. So, like, you can do, like, extra damage when that happens. You do, like, the slash, and they didn't see it coming, and so you do a lot of damage. But these memories, what's that called when you forget what you're not seeing at the moment? Like, when a baby just forgets because you're just hidden behind something.
Oh,
Anyway, there's a
yeah.
term for it. Permanence?
Object permanence? No.
Object permanence?
Maybe.
I think that's right. That sounds right. We'll go with that. So the enemies don't have any object permanence. Like, you can be right in front of them, and then you just duck behind this column, and they'll go like, "Huh? What happened? Where did this guy go?" And so you can immediately do the sash again, and it's goofy for a game that has this kind of semi-realistic look to it, where they were trying to go for kind of a realistic look. It just ends up being goofy. So I didn't really like the sash thing. Like, it was useful, but I thought it was goofy. But one thing I like in my action RPGs, or just action games in general, is a good parry system. And this game introduces its parry system pretty damn late.
Yes.
And that's kind of sad. And it doesn't quite work all that well, because I had the hardest time to get the timing right most of the time. And it's just like, if you press the block button at the exact right time when the enemy is attacking, you end up kind of like pushing them backwards, and you can counterattack for extra damage. And some boss fights and some regular enemies, like, just require that from you, and those could be really frustrating when you couldn't get the timing right. Now, to help you find what the right timing is, they have when you're in this. Anyway, I think we forgot to explain kind of an important part of the combat here. But when you activate the power of the Outsider, which draws the attention of all the enemies around you, and kind of gets them off your teammates' asses, you also get a kind of a line that shows that their attention is on you. You've got all these lines from all across the screen showing you, like, well, behind you and in front of you, and over there's like a whole bunch of enemies just aiming at you, gunning for you.
Think of like Tetris 99 when you're being targeted and you've got all these lines pointing at you. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's
That's
good.
what I was thinking
So
about when I saw
that's
this in the
happening.
game, yeah.
Yeah. And so when these lines become kind of this wider white line, that's when an attack is coming and you should parry. And that can send like spells back at the casters. It can send arrows back at the people who throw them. And it parries also sword attacks. But when you've got an enemy right in front of you, you're standing between the enemy and the line, and the line is very short because he's right in front of you. So, like, you couldn't really rely on the line. You had to rely on the animation, and the animation can get choppy at times. The game can get quite framey at times because the Wii was kind of underpowered for what they were trying to do here. And so it just ended up being frustrating at times. But it's still when the moment when that mechanic was introduced is kind of when the game combat became more interesting to me.
Yeah.
It's just a mechanic I like in Bayonetta or whatever.
Yeah, I think, Jordan, you were saying that when the mage move powers were introduced and you could actually control those, it added an intricate strategy that made the game more enjoyable.
Yeah, it also reminded me of Dragon Age Origins, because there's a lot of mage spells you get in that game when you're playing as a mage that function the same way, where you pause the game, you send out like a reticle or a kind of a spherical target on the ground, and you put it down where you want that to be. And that reminded me a lot of the combat in the last story. The auto attacks reminded me of Xenoblade a little bit too, in the way that you don't really control them; they just happen if you're close by an enemy. I meant to ask you guys if you had tried this, but apparently you can turn the auto attacking off. That is an option in this game. I don't know that a lot of people would play it that way, and the default is to have the auto attacks on. So I left them on, but I think you can turn it off. I don't know how that would help or hinder the use of the buttons in the game. I imagine it would make things worse. It would make escapability easier, so you'd eliminate that frustration, but I think maybe on the whole, most combat would become a little bit more tricky, maybe.
I'm like, wear you, out whatever button it was.
Yeah, who knows? It's probably pressing two buttons during the bloody Wii. I'm like you, David. I really like the late game combat. I think you're in this boat as well, where you've gotten most of the abilities. Everything is unlocked, and now you can kind of come up with more intricate strategies, or you need to use more intricate strategies to beat the bosses. That I guess I wasn't really expecting that from the game. It surprised me in a good way. That said, I thought that you learned mechanics and you didn't necessarily use them again. Or you didn't get that, okay, I've learned something new, now I should keep using that. It's more like something unlocks, and then you keep using the unlocked ability. But I don't know that you really learned a strategy for taking down a boss and then kept using that again, or kept maybe building on it or something. Like, I'm thinking of, like, the first, one of the first bosses you fight after you get that slash. It's this, I don't know what the hell it is. I don't know if it's a dog or like a stone creature of some kind in one of the dungeons, but it's charging at you and you need to use the slash ability to knock it down, and then it starts rolling around like a ball. Do you guys remember this battle? It's very early on.
Yeah.
And you don't really do anything like that. Again, I don't know that there's any other fight that requires the slash ability. You have options to use it, but in this fight you had to use it. Or I don't think you could be successful, or it might take you a really long time. But
I almost think every boss was unique that way, where there was always something, some mechanic that would help. But I wouldn't necessarily say, like, whatever strategy worked on one boss would work on another.
I guess I just wanted to see a little bit more of that progression. That, okay, I've used a new strategy, and then I get a chance to use it because I've mastered it. I get a chance to use it later. As long as I think back to the past boss fight, like, hey, this worked against that guy who turned into a ball. I should try that here. Instead, your partners always tell you what to do. There isn't really a discovery of what to do during a boss fight, because eventually, often maybe really early on, your partners will say, Zale, you have to do this to make the boss vulnerable. And I'm like, okay, like, I don't know. I didn't like that kind of hand-holding during the boss fights. And I thought the boss fights were probably the best part of the game. I think actually executing the moves and just doing the combat was fun. But I didn't like how you were spoon-fed the solution to every boss fight kind of puzzle. You know, like I wish there was a little bit, maybe some hints, or they could maybe just show you something. I don't know. But to just tell you outright what you need to do was a little bit... put me off a little bit. Just one more thing about the battle mechanics, though, and that's I get it, you know, the limitation of the Wii remote and the nunchuck. Holding A button to use Gale, which is Gale is the ability,
it's kind of an important mechanic.
It's the mechanic of the game. You use it the most, and you have to use it. Gale is poorly named, I think, but it's an ability that Zale uses to. He dash to an area and then create kind of like a circle of wind around him that activates your partner's magic spheres that they put on the ground. So you're constantly having to activate your partner's magic abilities to do different things, right? Like you you activate Mirania. She's a kind of a healing mage. She puts a healing circle on the ground. You can stand on the circle to heal yourself, or you can use the Gale ability on the circle to heal everybody around you. You'll heal all your teammates. What's the fire mage's name? I forget.
Oh, Yurik.
Yurik, yeah. So Yurik throws fireballs, but he also puts a fire circle on the ground. And if you activate that one, it's pretty important. It will break most enemies' guard or break their armor, so you can actually start attacking them or doing more damage. So you have to use this Gale ability so often. And yeah, I just hated having to hold the button. Sometimes it wouldn't even work, and I would die. Yep. And yeah, that was really frustrating, I thought.
You mentioned that the bosses, like the they would eventually always tell you what the trick was, yeah, how to beat them. But that was like almost every battle.
Yeah,
you know, like
yeah,
every encounter, right, is kind of there's this setup, and like you come upon enemies, and usually you see them first, and so the game tells you, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to, oh, look, there are pillars over their heads. You could try and bring them down on them using magic, or you can shoot at them with your pea shooter, whatever.
The crossbow.
And so, yeah, like they always gave you these binary choices. They just press left or right to select one of them. But as a result, like usually the solution was always kind of put in front of you before you even started combat. Or, you know, like, oh, do you want to try and surprise them, or do you want to just rush in? And like, well, of course I want to surprise them. I guess now I know that there's a way to surprise them, so I'm going to look for it. So it was always, yeah, like there was not a whole lot of, the game doesn't trust you to figure out stuff on your own, mm-hmm, kind of ever.
Yeah,
like it never really stops. That kind of thing is always going on.
Well,
even until the end.
Yeah, well, there's even tricks. I was telling Giva before we started, there seems to be tricks to beat some of the bosses as well. It's almost like a built-in, oh, if you're having trouble, do this. Like, for instance, there's a fight with Jarell when he becomes the cursed swordsman. Mm. And you can actually use a paralysis arrow on him so that you never have to take a hit against him. All you have to do is hit him with the arrow and then slash him. And then you just keep doing that until he dies. And then one of the final bosses, Zangarak, if you happen to have prank bananas on you, that boss fight is incredibly easy because you can shoot him with a prank banana. He falls, he drops his weapon, and you can pick up his weapon and hit him with it.
I'm so mad. I did not figure that out. And so I did the hard way with the parry move. And yeah, that took a while.
Yeah, the Zangarak one was pretty, it was shockingly easy for that one. It was almost disappointing because the fight that comes right after that was like the complete opposite. But
yeah, where was the trick for the, I don't think we should mention his name or a person's name for the final battle. But yeah, I really could have used some special trick there in the kind of the ultimate final boss of the game.
Well, I guess we can move on to the artwork. And Guy had mentioned it before that with that very Lord of the Rings aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's kind of immediately obvious and kind of undeniable. But of course, this is Sakaguchi. And I've mentioned on this podcast last time I was on that Final Fantasy, like they seem to drink the Studio Ghibli Kool-Aid a lot. Mm-hmm. They seem to really like, Of course, Nausicaa, because, you know, like the chocobos are straight out of that movie, but also lots of inspirations from Castle in the Sky. And Castle in the Sky makes an appearance in this game, I would say. And again, I'm pretty sure, like, it's undeniable, because there's this whole scene at some point where the Count Aragorn?
Argonon.
Okay, so Count Argonon is basically Colonel Muska from Castle in the Sky. Azulis Island, the island that you're on, is kind of in itself a super weapon. The whole story of this game is that ages ago, there was this never-ending war, and so this ruler, with the help of a sorceress who was also his consort, they brought down. Maybe I shouldn't get too much into details because it's kind of revealed little by little over the course of the game. So if I take away that kind of. Yeah, okay. Sorry, I won't get too much into it. But basically, there's a super weapon. And so, Castle in the Sky, of course, the castle itself is a super weapon. And the villains want to use that power to rule the world. And that's kind of what Countergun is doing here. And there's even, if that's not enough, the room that you're in is just composed of these kind of cubes that are made of stone or like some kind of eerily slick surface, and they hold together. There's no cement, they just seem to hold together magnetically or through some other force. And again, it's just straight out of Castle in the Sky. And then eventually those blocks fall apart when the energy holding them together is gone. And anyway, I was just seeing the scenes from that movie as I was watching this, you know, like it was just like, yep, that sure is taken right out of that movie. I don't grudge it or anything. I'm not upset about it, but it's kind of funny that Sakaguchi seems to have been imprinted by this movie. Like he seems to have really made an impression, you know, and I never would have, you know, before those movies made it over to North America, like North American players would never have known. To me, the chocobos were the original bird mounts, and I had no idea that they were taken from something else. And so it's kind of the same here. Like I'm sure that there's tons of references to other works that I don't get because I haven't been exposed to them. But yeah, it's just interesting. Sakaguchi has this like Miyazaki obsession, and I don't know, like the people behind Xenogears have this Neon Genesis Evangelion obsession. And yeah, the more anime that you watch and the more your video games start to like you start going like, huh, okay, I get it now. I know where this is from.
Even see now these days, like a lot of crossover with people who are actually in anime who are working on video games, like with Xenoblade Chronicles 2, where the character designer came from a designer from an anime, like he was making anime movies before he was brought on to design the characters for Xenoblade Chronicles 2. So
oh yeah, and there's like music from Xenoblade that I've heard in some mech anime, and it was like straight out of I was like, holy crap! Like I've heard this in Xenoblade. Was it just taken right out of that game? And it was just the same composer, and I guess like he just composes the same kinds of tunes over and over again. But yeah, no, there's definitely this kind of this crossover thing going on.
Yeah, it's a little tricky kind of just trying to decide whether things are, you know, deliberately taken. Is it an influence? Is it a reference? What is it exactly? I don't know. That this podcast, at least tonight, is getting too close to last call for us to debate that any further, I think. But I did want to say that I kind of like when those things happen. It reminds me of when I finally watched, how the hell am I forgetting this now? Who is Mr.
That's
Burns? Who is
right.
Mr. Burns from The Simpsons based on?
Oh,
You know
Howard
what I'm
Hughes.
talking about now.
Howard Hughes,
The
right?
William Randolph Hearst? No.
No,
He's based on a lot of
this
people,
very,
isn't
very famous movie, black and white. Why am I drawing a blank right now?
he? Oh, you're thinking of Orson Welles from Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane. Once you watch Citizen Kane, you understand like a thousand different things from old Simpsons episodes that you'd seen. Or when you go back and watch those episodes after seeing Citizen Kane, you realize so much of the references or jokes in that show come from this movie. So much of who Mr. Burns is as a character, at least in the early seasons, comes from the movie Citizen Kane, right? I like when those kind of things happen, when you play something or you're seeing things out of order. But then you go back and see something from the past, and you're like, "Oh, that's where it came from." I don't know. Just as a, you know, kind of casual observer, I like that. I like that kind of interaction. I like when that happens. To me, that's enjoyable. I think there are some times when it's malicious and it's meant to maybe deceive people and pretend like, oh no, this is my thing. I didn't borrow from this. I didn't use that. I didn't steal anything. Like, I think that's a bad thing, obviously. But I think there are times when it's done respectfully and with you're trying to shed light on an original product through your use of it or through your allusion to it. I think I like when that thing happens, but.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it's kind of a loving tribute. I'm sure it comes from a place of love. It's just funny to me. Mm. I said William Randolph Hearst. That's the person that Citizen Kane is based
right,
on.
Right, right. So that is correct still.
Yeah, but yeah. So David, you posted on Twitter a video. No, you tweeted about this game. About how you can hit your head on shop signs.
Yeah.
And so this game is a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
It does have a lot of funny animations. Sometimes it's a little bit goofy, like when you're about to fall from a ledge, like he kind of does this whole like, oh, I'm about to fall. And it's kind of actually distracting because you can't really do anything while that animation is playing out. But you can, like the pratfalls, like the prank banana that you can shoot at people, like they fall in a very satisfying way. The whole hitting your head thing is pretty cool. And you're constantly bumping into people. Yeah. And there's just, sometimes there's nothing funnier than like keep bumping into Kalista and she's, just shove her around and just being mean to her.
I don't know if you saw my tweet about where I shot the prank banana at the guy playing the accordion.
I've done that myself in my game.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny.
You guys are such jerks. Like, I didn't do anything like this in my game. Like, I was just, I would talk to people or I would ignore them, but I wasn't trying to upturn and harass everybody that I met in the street.
You got to go back and try it.
Yeah, you do. I don't know if this is a spoiler, but there's like this kind of side quest that I did not manage to access at all during the whole game. It's about like going to like this man across the river. I never really figured out the hints that the NPCs were telling me, but in the epilogue of the game, I talked to him and he tells you how many times you bumped into people,
oh, really?
How many times you bumped your head against signs, how many times you fell, because sometimes like there's going to be oranges on the ground and you're going to slip and things like that. And so for each of those things, he also rewards you. So I had bumped in over 300 people, and he kept giving me dragon skins.
That's awesome.
So, yeah,
so you're rewarded for being a jerk in this game, is what you're saying, Guy.
Yeah, and bumping repeatedly your head against things and all of that.
So being a jerk, being clumsy, disrupting people's lives, all of those things are positives here.
Finally, a game that I get rewarded for being who I am.
I thought you'd be really disappointed that you couldn't just kill everybody in the town.
Well, I tried. Don't
making
don't you worry.
Making them tripping over and over again is the
that little kid looking for his cat who's the roof. Yeah, you can be sure I threw a banana at him, but he didn't fall off, unfortunately.
Yeah, I did the same. We're all on the same page, Guillaume. I was shooting him, and I was getting upset that I couldn't hit him. So
speaking of knocking people down, just before we maybe move on to the characters. I hated so much in combat being knocked down, losing a life, basically, because it takes so bloody long for the animation of you and just for your health to rejuvenate and for you to get back in the fight. Getting knocked down was so frustrating. Like, I get, like, it's a punishment. You're kind of coming back or you're getting your second wind or whatever, but just during some of the boss fights where the frame rate or the speed of the game would really slow down anyways. And then for you to watch your character get knocked down and then sit there kind of unconscious for a few seconds and then slowly get back up, man, that was almost traumatizing. I just hated when that happened, especially later in the game.
Just before we move on to the characters, I just did want to mention the music was composed by Nobu Uematsu. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed. I thought it was a good soundtrack. There was a few different story beats where I just thought the music suited the mood, especially like there was a few parts at the end where, they're gathering, they're getting hope, or they're their spirits are lifting, and then the music is playing and starts picking up. And I felt, I don't know if it's as memorable as some of the Final Fantasies, but I felt like it was still a solid soundtrack.
Yeah, no, it was quite good. I got the CD with the game. I don't think I ever put it in the CD player, but yeah, it's a decent soundtrack, and some of the nicer kind of arrangements of those, because there's always, like, it's always the same themes coming back, the same musical themes, I mean. But yeah, some of the better arrangements come later in the game, I find.
Mm-hmm.
I thought some of the emotional scenes between Callista and Zale had some really good music, actually. Those were the tracks I noticed the most. Like one early on in the game, when you're first looking at the stars with her, I thought the music there was quite good. I think they played again in the epilogue too. And those ones, I thought the music worked well. The battle music's pretty good too, actually.
I think the greatest strength of the game is in the characters. Now, it's kind of funny that they grated on us so much at the beginning, but after the initial few hours, I just feel like the characters, a lot of depth was built. Like the one dimensionality of Seren and Lowell kind of goes away, and as you meet the other characters and you get the backstories of each of the characters as you get deeper into the game, it just felt like it was like a party of friends, and you got to know everybody. And by the end, I was invested in I think every one of them, really. Like, I wouldn't necessarily say there was any I particularly disliked. I really liked them all at the end, and I thought they were all very well voice acted. To me, that was, if I was going to say what I liked most about the game, I would say it was the way that the characters were presented. Mm.
I agree with you, David. I think the voice acting was excellent. It certainly made it more enjoyable to, like, some of the cutscenes I skipped, but the ones where you couldn't just fast forward, you were actually just watching the computer generated cutscenes. Like those ones, I liked the voice acting there, and I thought they were pretty entertaining. To me, the overall cast wasn't the strongest, and I think it's because they start off so weak. I did kind of bond with them a little bit more by the end, but I thought I spent so many hours with the game before I got to that point where I actually started liking them. I was thinking, I put in the notes here that maybe my general dislike of the game could have overshadowed the development of any feelings for the characters. I think that's possible. Like, if I was having a better time, I might have been more invested in doing some of the side quests that you need to do, or the optional missions to find out more about them. Like, I know that Seren and Lowell near the end of the game, like, there are full chapters you can devote to learning a little bit more about their backstory, and I just kind of skipped over those because I was rushing to finish the game, but I also just didn't feel like I wanted to know more about them. Like, I was at a point where it was like, you've already turned me off enough that, like, maybe there is something redeeming for you, but if it happens, it happens. And I do think by the game, I most of the characters had redeemed themselves to a point for me. I really liked Zale. I think I liked Callista probably the most from the beginning of the game, even though she's not as present as some of the other characters. I think Dagrin was a good character, kind of a good foil for Zale as well, kind of that mentor for him as well. I don't think Zangarak was a very compelling villain. Like, he wasn't around. He wasn't doing anything. Like, he was always behind the scenes, and he's this looming evil that you never see. And I think those kind of villains don't work very well. Like, Final Fantasy IX has a villain like that as well. Like, they're kind of the puppet master, but they're not ever really on screen very much. And I think that is a weakness here in the for the overall cast.
Yeah, it's funny because the version of the game that I got came with an art book, and so you've got some of the backgrounds, you've got some of the character art, and I can't remember the guy's name, but I think one of the I don't even remember the context of the story where he would show up, but I think he's just like some random mercenary or thug that's kind of like your rival, and you see him for
Zoran.
Zoran. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So he's got his character art in that little booklet, but Sangarak doesn't. Mm. So that kind of shows you just how much they thought about that villain. Like, he's not even worth putting in a little art book that they included with the game. Yeah, I don't have that much to say about the characters, but David, you mentioned the voice acting, so I'm just going to decide that my favorite guy is this guy, and I hope it's going to come through clearly enough, but...
What do you call this? Here I thought the king of the Garak would be tough. He's nothing but a coward.
Captain, perhaps we should...
Right! It'll make a nice winter home when I retire!
Oh, that's the captain of the knights, right? The cowardly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. Right. So was that, I don't know if that was loud enough, but oh my god. Maybe you can find like the scene on YouTube or something.
Yeah.
But some of the voice acting, my god, they definitely got the instruction to be as over the top as they could. Like, there was sometimes you'll just pass next to some random knights and like this guy is just like, I love being a knight. It's fantastic. And oh my God, like, what are you doing? It's kind of, I don't know. It made me chuckle, but it's, the voice acting is of a varying quality, I thought. But yeah, the characters, I got attached to them just, by virtue of spending a lot of time with them, I guess. But, yeah, Soren and Laurel never really grew on me. Their story, I thought, kind of went exactly where I thought it would, and it's kind of not enough.
Yeah.
Killista is all right, but she's not really... She's just a trope, right? She's just the caged bird who... and, like, literally, in the epilogue of the game, again, like, she's got a caged bird in her room, and in the epilogue, it's escaped, and she's... happy for the bird. It's like, okay, I get it. I get what you're doing here. And Zell maybe is a little bit too naive for his own good. And there are some kind of, I guess, twists that I saw coming just because the game made them maybe a little bit too obvious. So, they were all right.
Yeah. I think, I'm trying to remember, there was one at the beginning. I don't want to ruin it either, but there was a couple little things at the beginning where it's like, I see where you're going with this. I have a feeling that this thing is going to happen by the end at some point. And then there was a couple more where like, okay, like you're not really hiding this anymore. You know?
Yeah. So I guess we can start talking about the story then, the last story.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
As it were.
The story had, it was fine, I guess is how I would put it. I felt like the pacing was not great. It felt like there was times where we were jumping pretty quick. Like, events were happening really quick, and then all of a sudden there'd be like step backwards that didn't make sense, and then periods of time, like, to the point where, so they start off as mercenaries, and then eventually like they get the Count's favor. And then the Count wants to use him as a pawn or whatever, but then he ends up back in the dungeon for some reason, and I'm like, okay, at this point, like, the Count is relying on Zale as an ally, and now we're going backwards again. And it almost felt like they just needed to reuse the dungeon asset, so that's why I ended up back in there. And then I don't know, it's hard to say like what was happening in 2012, but like, playing it today, I just felt like some of the stuff was so tropey and patriarchal, where with like there was a lot of like men defending the women that didn't feel great. Like, first of all, like the Zale, it was a little too protect, like Zale needing to protect Callista or save her from her situation because she can't deal with it on her own. Like, it just felt a little too strong there. There was actual, in the haunted dungeon, Dagrin literally says, man saving a woman just like it should be.
I remember that.
And I'm like, oh man, like this is rough. Like, some of this hasn't aged well. And then, even when Callista finally does fight back, she like slaps Count Aragorn in the face like a, and I'm like, ah, she just decked him. Like, she's a warrior at this point, and, yeah. But she just kind of slaps him and what, you know, I don't know. There's a few things there where it's like, I don't know, maybe in 2008 or something when they're developing. And I mean, Sakaguchi's like from kind of old school too. Like, I mean, a lot of Final Fantasies are that way too. So it's, I see where it comes from, but it's kind of disappointing in 2019 to be seeing some of that stuff, because you're just thinking like, ah, we're kind of past this now. Like,
yeah, I guess an argument could be made that it's just the world that the game takes place in, right? And I think that the whole, because it's a big theme of the game that she can't do what she wants. She has to do what her uncle, the Count, wants, because that's the type of society that it is. So I think I agree about her being a warrior and being, you know, like she's been into fights. She could definitely punch out her uncle or Geralt or whoever. But in terms of the story, it kind of makes sense that she is just, she just has to go with the flow. They do explain at some point that every time that someone has tried to help her, they've just disappeared. They've died, you know, like she knows that there's like intrigue and stuff going on in the castle. And so in a way she is trying to protect Zael, from that and trying to push him away because she likes him. So she's pushing him away because, again, tropes and things we've seen before. But yeah, like I don't know, like a lot of the stuff, I'm like you, like I thought like, well, I see where this is going. This is not super original. But I was kind of surprised by how effective a certain thread ended up being. And that's the one with like Zael and Calista. Like Zael, the whole game with Dagrun, like they're always going on about how it was their childhood dream to become knights. And so, you know, mercenaries are not well regarded. People see them with suspicion, and knights are so awesome, and they're going to be knights one day. It's going to be so awesome to finally reach this lifelong dream. And you see more and more like the peeling comes off, like the veneer peels off, like the Zael realizes that knights aren't all that they're cracked up to be, that they may be nobles, but they're not noble. You know, like the nobility is like, they've got the title, but are they really good people? So you realize that maybe not really. And he realizes that they have to follow the orders of this Count, who he's not sure that he trusts. And so comes a big day, like he's kind of, because he's got the power of the outsider, because the Count wants to use him for this power, he gets into his good graces and he's going to become a knight and he's going to be able to marry Calista. And I found that the kind of like the big day where he's going to be made a knight and he goes outside and he's just like, I'm really not feeling it. This is not what I thought I was signing up for. This is not how I imagined it. And I don't know, there was something about the way that the voice acting and the way that those scenes were put together that was more effective than I thought they would be. Because I saw that scene coming, you know, like, of course, this is where this game is headed. But they really, I don't know, I almost like tweeted right at that moment, like, oh wow, like this game really sticks the landing. And that's after tweeting about how this game really doesn't hold up. You know, so I was really, I don't know, so I was really satisfied with that aspect, with that thread of the story. But then the game goes on for like 5 more hours. And it goes into stuff that I was less interested in, but maybe I'll let Jordan speak before I...
Yeah, I think this idea of there being high points in the game that you can almost, like if there were more of them, more of those peaks, I suppose, and fewer of the valleys, that maybe this would be still be in 2019 a very strong game. I wonder if one of the reasons why it was more critically regarded when it first came out was because people, A, were playing it, maybe the way it was meant to be played with the pointer controls, or because there just weren't any, basically weren't any RPGs on the Switch. I mean, Xenoblade Chronicles came out a few months before this game did, before The Last Story did. But I remember it being quite rare and not that many people actually playing it either. So there might not have been that all that much comparison between the two games. Maybe people chose one or the other. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know that the story really resonated with me. There were moments I enjoyed, but for me, it was really the boss battles, the combat elements that were more enjoyable to me. I think it's the world, the environment, the fact that you kept going back to the same places. Like there was never really much that was new. You would trigger story beats just by leaving the castle and coming back. Like there just little things like that just kind of found annoying. The middle part of the game I found very claustrophobic. I felt like you were just going back and forth between the town and the castle and going and back and forth. And yeah, I wanted to go to new places. I liked when you were on your ship ran aground or you kind of had to make repairs. And so you go out and you find this other ship and you're exploring that with Yurik and you learn a little bit about his past. I thought that was an effective chapter in the game, actually. But then it's immediately followed by the chapter with Mirania, or maybe you can play them out of order, I don't know, where she goes into the forest and is talking about this natural being, the guardian of the forest who has died or who is dying and how that's affecting the planet. Or I guess it's a symptom of what's going on with the planet. And I thought that mission just totally missed for me. Like, there was nothing really interesting about that scene or any of those scenes. A lot of it was just scolding Mirania for running ahead or maybe caring too much. Like you followed up one of the stronger chapters in the game, in my mind, with one of the weaker ones. And yet to me, that was the overall problem with the pacing, is that the high points were just so isolated. And I never really got like, okay, here's something good. I'm waiting for the next thing that's really good. And I have to go through three or four duds before I get there. And so that the narrative momentum just didn't exist for me in this game. The twist, I think, is quite telegraphed. I think we talked about that a little bit. I think it's a little bit unearned. I don't want to spoil it. I think it is worth kind of learning that. But I think anyone who's played this game or who is going to play this game, I think you'll figure out pretty early on what is going to happen by the end of the game. Not as simply as like, oh, of course the good guys win. Yeah, obviously. But there's some of the things that you can kind of figure out. This is just an anecdote from my time with the game. Very early on, you exit the pub. You're given like Ariella, I think, is the owner of the pub or the wife of the pub's owner, something like that. She's kind of running the pub. And she says to you, oh, can you go out and get some fireworks or go out and get... they've run out of alcohol. So you need to go up and pick up more beer, right? And I thought that was the next story mission. So I go outside... And then there's someone calling to me. You can hear a woman's voice. And I'm like, oh, I was fully prepared to just ignore that. I thought that was the side quest. And okay, I'll ignore this woman calling out from this area who needs help. I'll just go and get the alcohol, bring it back to the pub. But at the last second, I'm like, no, I'll do the little side quest first. Then I'll do the main thing. And it turns out that you find Callista, who's kind of disguised herself as Lisa. She's running away from the guards of around the city or the knights. And that turns out to be the next story quest. And I never actually went back and got the alcohol for the pub. I don't even know if you're supposed to or if you can. Like you,
I think I did.
So that you can do that, right? Okay.
I think you can, yeah. But eventually you're going to run into Lisa. Right. You're going
to get
her away from the guards.
I had the exact same experience, Jordan, I was happy to go get the booze.
Yeah. I'm like, that's the main thing.
Yeah, because I went back afterwards and I'm like, okay, where's the booze person? I can't find the booze person.
Yeah, no, but by that point, I'm just like, oh, I guess we're going on with the story. I'm not going to come back to that. And I wonder if it's the way that this game does optional content or does side content. It's very, very out of the way, or it's pushed to the periphery, I guess. You can totally ignore it or miss it or not really care about it and just go through the story. I don't feel a lot of the game compelling you to explore or to go out and find out what's out there. I think you are really pushed down this linear path. And ironically, the game itself, the environments are super linear as well. There's so little exploration. And I know that's not necessarily the story, but to me, the way you experience the world is tied into it. And so I think that's one of the reasons why the story didn't do it for me.
You mentioned the town and how you didn't really enjoy. I eventually, like initially, I didn't really like the town because it seemed to just have me look for doodads on the ground. But eventually, towards the middle of the game, I kind of enjoyed the way that it hinted at its side quests. And I don't even know like if they could have been skipped or no, because the way that this game has like chapters, kind of wonder if I skipped a chapter here or there. Or if I could have.
The chapters 21, 22, 23, and 24, I think, are all optional.
There's a lot. I think there's up to 8 chapters, maybe 7 or 8 that are all optional. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So I kind of found it interesting that just by walking around in the town, sometimes you'll see an NPC and they'll say like, oh, so-and-so over there lost his sister or something, or there's something going on with this well, or like this house is really creepy and stuff is happening over there. And so it's up to you to follow their instructions and kind of go find out what's going on. And then you trigger the side quest. And I thought it was a really interesting and organic way to send you to do side quests. At the same time, sometimes it played against the fact that they were not put in the list, or that they were not forced on you, or that they were so easy to miss, made it seem like, okay, like, you know, once you've done a few of them and you kind of can't find any more, is it because you've done them all or just because you haven't found the right NPC to talk to? So that was kind of annoying. Like, I wish that the game better signaled like, okay, you're done. You can go do the story mission now. Because there have been times when I've wasted more time in town than I needed to, just because I was just trying to make sure that I hadn't missed anything before I triggered the next story scene. And sometimes also NPCs didn't seem to react the way that you'd think they would when, you know, like when you've cleansed the haunted house, basically. Some of the NPCs are still talking about how it's haunted and creepy. Yeah. And I was like, okay, like, did I forget something? But yeah, I think that maybe it was just a limitation of they forgot, or they couldn't afford that much voice acting or whatever.
Yeah. Just one last thing before we move on to last call is I know that Guillaume had brought up and I thought it was kind of funny, the fact that a lot of the game builds up the symmetry between the Gurak and the human, and that you're essentially trying to like bring the two races back together.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then even in the epilogue, the third race, the Reptids, are still like the scum of society.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into this. I'll try to be brief. Anyway, so basically, you've got the humans and you've got the Guraks, who are basically orcs. They're just orcs. That's how it is. But they call them Guraks because they don't want to get sued by the
Tolkien folks.
What's his name? Tolkien. Yeah. Estate. And so the game sets up this idea that first, like, you slowly realize that the humans are the aggressors. They maybe didn't start out this way, but Count Arganon is definitely trying to wipe out the Guraks, and there's no doubt that the Guraks are kind of evolved and cultured. And the game sets them up like they say that they're maybe more technologically advanced, and the humans have like magic, but I don't think that the game really followed that through. Like, I think it's mentioned at some point, but it doesn't really, I don't think it really comes up as like in the gameplay or in the game's world. Mm-hmm. But the orcs, I think, and I'm just throwing that out there. Like, I'm a white dude and I haven't done all the reading, and I haven't done, like, I don't really know. And I also, as I've admitted, like, I don't read that much fantasy. in the first place, but it has been studied and talked about that the orcs in Tolkien-esque fantasy are kind of stand-ins for other races, for black people, for... like anyway, so the world of the last story is incredibly white. There are no black humans in this game. The Goraks, who are down south, are you know, more kind of physically strong, and I don't know, like there are issues with the way that with orcs, basically, like they are racially coded. They are, oh my god, I'm so ill-equipped to be talking about this. But there's like the orcs are, you know, like depicted as kind, you know, bestial and, you know, strong and kind of scary. And I'm not sure. I think I'm venturing into waters a little bit too deep for me here. But the Goraks kind of share the same traits, and I think they've got the same issues. They've got the same kind of racial coding, and that's kind of not great. And I'm not saying that the game is racist, or I'm not saying that the Sakaguchi was especially making a point about these are kind of like unexamined tropes. This is what happens when you are just replicating tropes and you don't really think about what those tropes entail.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so as you mentioned, like the game kind of tries to set up the symmetry between the orcs and the humans. They're both two sides of a war. They're both trying to wipe out the other at a certain point. Like the orcs, the Goraks are defending themselves from the humans who are the invaders, but they're also trying to wipe out the humans because it's the only way that they're going to have peace, or as they see it. So the game eventually also, like, you explore their home world, like their continent, and there are civilians, and they're just living their lives. They're just like women and children who are cooking and playing and doing whatever it is that people do. And so Zael realizes, like, wait, like, we're really going to be... like, why are we wiping out these people again? Like, why can't we just live with them? And even, like, towards the end, like, there's the epilogue is, you know, peace at last. The two peoples are together, and it ends with, like, this little Gurek kid all alone on the Zulus Island, and this human kid extends a hand to him, and they're going to be playing together. And so, like, oh, like, maybe the rift between the two peoples is mended, and we're not so different after all, you know?
Mm.
But at the same time, they've introduced this third race in the game, the Reptids, who just, like, come out of the sewers, come out of, like, live under the island. Basically, they speak, they have speech, like, they have intelligence, they have a culture, it seems, because when you go into their catacomb, like, they've got statues, they've built stuff. So they are also kind of sentient, like a third species, and the game never questions why you're killing them or why they're violent towards you. And it's funny because, like, in the epilogue, like, there are a few extra dungeons, extra chapters that you can do, and one of them involves the Reptids, and, like, they're kind of, like, going crazy underground or something. Like, there's some sort of, like, there's something in the water, and they're not acting normally. And I thought, like, oh, okay, maybe the game waited all this time to finally introduce, like, some humanity, quote-unquote, in the Reptids. But no, like, they're still just fodder. There's just, like, fodder for you know, for you to gain experience in combat. They're kind of the race that was introduced so that you could kill stuff over and over again without introducing, without introducing that kind of, like, ethical element of, like, well, the Goraks are really not so different from us, right?
Well, and there's they're in the castle, I can't remember, it might be, like, halfway or three quarters of the way through, where there's one of the knights, if you talk to them, they say, oh, well, we have this letter for you, Zael, and you read the letter, and it's, like, a Reptid who wants, like, vengeance for Zael killing their people.
Right.
And so you go outside the castle to, like,
have and you just kill more of them.
Yes. And it's supposed to be a one-on-one.
Wave after wave of Reptids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, and it's weird because, like, Seren, at some point in the first time that you go through the catacombs, she makes a joke about, like, making boots out of their skin. Like, there's, like, in the epilogue mission that I mentioned, like, they flat out mention, like, oh, we should exterminate them. Like, we should, like, they talk about them as vermin. even though clearly they've got intelligence. And
yeah,
it's really weird. Like, this game is trying to have its cake and eat it too, you know. Like, it's trying to have this ambivalence about, like, should we really be having war, should we really be battling these other peoples, but then, like, these questions don't apply to the Reptids, it seems.
Yeah. Well, if Nintendo had just let them do their futuristic setting, they could have been just killing robots.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. But what if the robots are sentient, David?
Well, that's just a can of worms. Can of worms too many.
We'll have to wait for Last Story 2. Coming to mobile soon.
Oh, they could stay there.
Sorry, David.
Drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol. Get going.
Well, that's the perfect segue into the last call, because
no doubt.
If we're bringing up mobile, we've gone too far.
Get the hell out of the page pub.
That's right. For tonight's last call, the question I have for you guys is, do you consider The Last Story a must-play RPG?
There are very few RPGs that I think are must-play. I think people's time can probably be used in better ways than play some most our RPGs. So I would say no, but that's, like, I would say that about, like, yeah, like 95% of RPGs. Like, I get into them because I'm hopeless, but so I don't think so. But we've been pretty harsh in this game this whole time, but I feel like it did have some good moments for me. If we were to chart my enjoyment with it, like, it pretty much peaked at 70% through the game. And then, like, there's, like, peaks and valleys, as we've described. What's funny is that before, over the past week, I went back and listened to old RFN episodes where people were talking about this game. So James Jones and Johnny Metz, like, James, I think, had more reservations, but Johnny, like, this was, like, his game of the year 2011 or 2012. It was, like, he freaking gushed about it. He loved this game, and I wish... I don't think that if I had played through it back then, it would have made even as much of an impression on me as it did on him, but I feel like maybe I would have liked it more than I did today. So I kind of wish I had, like, the optimal experience, which would have been to experience it back when the Wii was relevant and was the... But yeah, like, it's weird. Like, yeah, I guess you can't really put yourself back in the mindset of someone in 2012 who, like, the Wii is on its last leg. There's not a whole lot of JRPGs coming to the West in the first place, not just on the Wii, but, like, across the board. It was kind of a bleak scene. Like, Atlus, like, the Persona team didn't even make a Persona game for that generation until the very, very end when the PS3 was dead. And so they released it on PlayStation 4 at the same time. But yeah, like, the... Anyway, so it was, like, a weird time for Japanese RPGs, and so I think that The Last Story probably landed better back then because of that, because that's what you were getting. Whereas now, new RPGs are coming out, and also there's more options to go back to classics than ever. You know, the Switch is getting ports of the Wazoo. So I think there are a ton of RPGs that would be more must-play to me than The Last Story.
Yeah,
that are in the Switch.
I agree with that. Must-play RPG. Like, if I'm thinking of this, you know, this is an RPG podcast. We're talking about RPGs. So I'm thinking about RPG fans. Like, even in the most hardcore of RPG fans, I couldn't say this is a must-play game. I just think there's other games that have taken similar mechanics and done them so much better. Like, we mentioned Xenoblade Chronicles. It came out a few months before Last Story. I think it does combat. I think I prefer the combat there. Dragon Age came out 3 years. Dragon Age Origins came out 3 years before this game. The combat has less depth, but I enjoyed it better in that game. It was less annoying. It was more simple and to the point. And you kind of knew what was happening at every moment. Mass Effect came out before this. The original, which was, again, the more RPG style combat as opposed to the action combat that it would become. And again, I think that was more compelling as well. The Last Story, we didn't get a chance to talk about some of the smaller mechanics like leveling up and armor equipment, swords and stuff like that you equip. And I think those are all terrible. You find treasure chests, and I don't know if it is actually a random draw, but a stupid roulette pops up when you open a treasure chest that makes it seem like it's a random pickup. And why?
And then every item that you pick is identical to the last.
Oh yeah, they all have the same name.
Picking up feather greaves after feather greaves.
It's either feather greaves or leather greaves,
copper sword,
or brave greaves or steel greaves. Like, there's no creativity to any of the armor. So the weapons eventually get better names, but then to improve the weapons, it's plus one, plus two, plus three. You see the attack go up or the magic attack go up. It's so basic and rudimentary. And I just didn't like that at all. I was just mentioning the leveling up or the progression. It seems like, and I know this isn't true, but it seems like every time you ended combat, you gained a level. And what is the point? What is the point of every time you fight a battle, you gain a level? That's effectively like not gaining a level ever. So there's no point having an experience point system if every single time you have a mandatory combat, you gain a level. And then the enemies accordingly level up or scale with you. So like, I suppose you can do some grinding. There are opportunities actually where the game sets up a little sigil on the ground that you can activate, and you can replay battles to get more money, or to get more equipment, or crafting materials, or whatever, and of course to level up your characters if you want to. And that's all well and good, but I think for the most
part, but it's always summoning the same enemies.
Yeah,
right? So it's always the same battle. So it's just like, okay, you summon the enemies, you kill them, you get some experience, you summon them again, and you kill them. Like, it's just like, until you don't level up so easily anymore.
It's the most.
And then, okay, I guess I can move on.
It's the most maybe accurate use of the word grinding. You are literally grinding on the exact same fights or the exact same enemies. And yeah, I just, some of those things, like, I guess those RPG mechanics that I look forward to, I just don't think they worked out very well. There was no satisfying, like, going in a dungeon and finding a new item, or going in a dungeon and maybe wanting to, grind a little bit, run around and fight some option. I don't know that there is any optional combat in this game. I think every time you find enemies, you must defeat them to progress.
Oh, yeah, like, in the story, that's the case.
Every time you're doing a main story mission, anytime you're doing any chapter...
I don't think I ever went to the arena.
Oh, yes, you're right. Dave, you want to talk about that arena? Did you do it? I skipped that part.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't bother. Like, I skipped the arena stuff, but I did do the Reptid, like, outside of the... It was funny, because the one outside... So the first time I did the outside battles with the Reptids, the amount of stuff they dropped was incredible, but they don't give you time to actually pick them up.
Oh, yeah, that's so dumb, too. Yeah. Sometimes the story progresses too fast, or you go to the next cutscene in the next room, and then you can't collect the items that were just dropped. So you have to either collect them fast, or sometimes you can't even get them at all, I don't think.
Yeah, or you kind of have to get them while you're fighting, because eventually I must have killed the right person, and then it's like, oh, well, you killed him now. And then it just fired me back to the castle, and I'm like, ah, crap.
Yeah.
I left all that stuff that I could have picked up.
I think there's enough flaws in this game that it's not a must-play in my mind. And I suppose if you... we're thinking, okay, I want to play every RPG on the Wii because there's not that many. You might find yourself playing the last story. But I think other games have done what it does a lot better, with a more compelling cast, a better story, better environments. To me, it's a very middling RPG. And I do kind of want to figure out why the critical reception was more positive. Like, I think the game's about an 80 on Metacritic, give or take. And I want to look at reviews. I want to see what people really enjoyed about this one, because I can understand some of the things we brought up that are enjoyable, but to me there just wasn't enough of that in the game. And for the most part, the chapters were, I was just trying to get through them to get to the end of the game. I wasn't really enjoying myself necessarily. I found it more of a chore to get through the last story, and I obviously wanted to do that for the podcast, and I almost got there, 95% of the way, but yeah, just I wouldn't call it a must play. There, like Guy said, there are so many more games that deserve that title.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a must play, but I think I would call it a worthwhile play for a couple of reasons. One is if your goal was to play like the best RPGs on each console, I think this would be one of them. Like, it's funny because like the ones, I guess there's not a ton to choose from, I suppose. But for the Wii, it seems like a good option to go with. It was enjoyable enough. I guess the litmus test that I use for my RPGs is how motivated I am to finish the game. Because with the amount of games that we play now, especially with like the site and stuff, I can easily just completely lose interest and not want to bother anymore. And if I have to like push through for a review or something like that, like I can really feel it. And I didn't have that feeling with Last Story. Like, even though I probably should have started it a little earlier on so that I didn't have to rush in the last couple of days, I still didn't feel, it didn't feel like a chore to me. Like, I still was enjoying what I was doing. There was a few points where I'm like, oh, okay, let's move on with the story. Like, you know, this, we don't need to continue on this part. But for the most part, I enjoyed my time with it. So there's the significance of it being one of the best on the Wii. And then the other significance is that it might be Sakaguchi's last console, and it might be worth playing it just for the historical significance. Like, I guess there's always the possibility he does another one later on, but I mean, he's not getting younger, and he's got a big project with Apple now that I don't see myself ever picking up. So for someone who's a Final Fantasy fan like myself, to play this last one, I think being able to just experience it and say, yeah, like I've played this, you know, I played his last one. Yeah. The stuff that he's making on a mobile is not for me, and I'm not going to touch it, but I did manage to get the last one in and enjoyed it. So,
yeah, I think it's unfortunate because I do like the idea of a shorter RPG. I just, but it's unfortunate that it didn't manage to avoid the, having tedious parts or, yeah, you know, like having repetition and things like that. I could have used an even shorter RPG, to be honest, but I don't know. And there was a one point in the game that I was really kind of high on it. And I've already, like, it's when around the part where Zale decided, like, can get his knighthood. Like, I thought, like, oh, finally, okay, like, this is, I don't know, this is surprisingly good. But then the game just kept going and kind of lost that momentum. And then you're kind of sent through fight after fight against enemies. Like, you know, if you think that Zangarak is not much of a character in this game, wait until you see, like, his lackeys.
Yeah.
That you also have to fight, like, they're non-entities, right?
And
they're
just come out of nowhere, really. Like, you were never really introduced to them.
No, so they're just there to be killed, basically, to be additional boss fights. So that's kind of unfortunate. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I wouldn't discourage anyone who already has the game. Like, to, you know, like, sure, go ahead and finish it. I'm glad that we did this podcast because I've got this, you know, off my back now. Like, it's off my backlog, and I guess I'm glad I've played it finally. But I wouldn't say go and yeah, go grab it, and especially if you don't have a Wii U or a Wii to play it on. Like, it's not worth getting a system for that.
Yeah. Do you guys have any final thoughts before we wrap it up?
I think people know how you feel about this game.
We've talked about it up and down, I think, without being pretty good to avoid spoilers as well. So
yeah. Well, the important thing is there's one more title off the backlog. So
yes, for like sure, you said, for sure.
Yep. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of The Thirsty Mage. If you enjoyed it, please let us know by reviewing us on your podcast player of choice. Also, while you're in there, make sure to subscribe to Guillaume's podcast, Radio Free Nintendo, where he, James, John, and Greg talk about what they've been playing and take emails from folks and about Nintendo-related topics. It's the Nintendo podcast for adults made by professionals.
It's that word podcast. It gets you every time, David.
It gets me every time.
Every time.
I'm glad I added this
last time. Last time I was on, I kind of found myself in the surprising position of having to plug my own podcast, and that never happens. And I realized just how ill-prepared I am for that. Like, we like Nintendo? Yeah. So it's not really much of a pitch. So if, you know, if listeners of the Thirsty Mage have never listened to Radio Free Nintendo, I think a good episode to start with would be The episodes 349 and 352, we did a retroactive for Pandora's Tower. Mm. And so the retroactives are like we pick an old game, or not so old game for that one, and we all play it together and then we discuss it. So it's kind of the same format that we're doing here. So I think it would be a good entry point if you've never listened to Radio for Nintendo. And Pandora's Tower, of course, is a fellow Operation Rainfall title. And it kind of surprised me in that it might be like my favorite of the bunch. I really took to it. I really enjoyed that game's kind of action and its weird universe. I suggest people check it out.
And Radio Free Nintendo is how I ended up at Nintendo World Report. So the Thirsty Mage's origins are steeped in from listening to Radio Free Nintendo. So
yeah, I listened to Radio Free Nintendo before I was on Radio Free Nintendo. And then it all went to shit.
Oh, that's James's fault, Guillaume, not yours.
James does his best. We all do our best.
And you can also get more of Jordan Rudick on the eShop Action Committee podcast, where he and Don Koopman discuss the latest titles to hit the Switch eShop.
Yeah, we do a monthly podcast, Don and I. It's a lot of fun. We just kind of go over the titles that we've played. Not just games we've reviewed, sometimes games we've just dabbled in, and we have a pretty good banter back and forth about a bunch. And one of the funny things that happens on the show is that Don will talk about a game I've never heard of, and I'll go and check it out, or just from listening to him, I'll be like, I need to play this game. I want to buy this right now, and I'll just go and download it while we're recording the podcast. So that's kind of a funny thing. Often we talk about we've played different games. I play games that he missed out on and vice versa. So you'll get a kind of a wide variety of Switch eShop titles being discussed as well. So if you're into the smaller games, there's a healthy amount on the Switch eShop. It's a little bit hard to kind of parse them and find the good ones. So you've listened to the podcast, eShop Action Committee. We're happy to give people recommendations. But also, maybe we talk about some games that you might want to avoid as well. So you get a little bit of both there.
And finally, going into 2020, we're doing a lot better job of pre-planning and sticking to our plans now. And so we're going to be doing a look at Final Fantasy V. Mm-hmm. So anyone listening who has access to Final Fantasy V... by any means, we're not going to ask questions. If you manage to get a copy of it, feel free to play. And then by mid-January, I believe the January 15th, I think the episode will be. Not sure the exact date, but mid-January is when we'll actually do the show. So if you want to play along with us, you could check us out on Discord. There's a Final Fantasy V channel now. You can find that through the Thirsty Mage Twitter account. It's just at the Thirsty Mage. And all of our Twitters are attached one way or another. We're usually talking or whatever, so you'll be able to find the three of us through there as well. But yeah, if you want to send us an email, the email is david@thethirstymage.com. If you want to provide your insight on Final Fantasy V, we'll take a look. And if we can, we'll read a few on the show if we have a chance, and we'll have a little bit of a audience participation going forward on our retro lookbacks. So if anyone's looking to get into Final Fantasy V like we are, now's the time. So make sure to get it on. I guess the GBA might be one of the easier legal ways to get it. So
yeah, I don't know. I think that if you've got a Vita or a PSP, you can play the PS1 version. I think you can play it on PS3 as well. The problem with the PlayStation 1 version is it has pretty heinous load time. So I think the GBA is probably the best version of that game, just because it doesn't have the load times before the battles happen. It's random encounters, turn-based combat. So loading before or after every fight is very, very cumbersome, and you might grow to hate the game based on that. So, David, you're playing the GBA version as well, is that right?
I'm playing a version.
Okay, let's just call it the GBA version. but I'm definitely playing a fully... I don't even know if it's fully legal. It might be a repro cart. So I'm playing on a DS Lite. All I can tell you is,
I've been telling people I play the way Guillaume plays his.
Yeah, I've tried so many times to play it in a legitimate way. Like, I actually, like you, Jordan, you mentioned the PlayStation 3, PSP.
Yeah,
The version that I have does not play on either of those. I don't know why. Like, my PSP Go, my PlayStation 3 can't play the Anthology version or the CD.
Oh, yeah, okay, right.
So, yeah, so it just doesn't work. So, I've tried that. I've also, Johnny listened to me on RFN, you know, heard me say that I wanted to play the game and couldn't, and he offered to just mail me his GBA cart. And I was like, oh yeah, sure, that's very generous. But Johnny has been moving a lot in the past 5 years, and so absolutely can't find the card anymore. Yeah. So, like, you know, like I think the universe keeps telling me, like, you don't have to wait for a legit way to experience this game. So I think I've earned it at this point, you know.
I'm going with that too. I own the Final Fantasy Anthology, and Square has gotten more money than I can count at this point over my lifetime. So I'm pretty sure they're pretty cool with however way I'm able to play that Final Fantasy V. That's my story anyway. I'm pretty comfortable with
it. With our luck, they're probably going to put Final Fantasy V on Switch like the day after we post the the episode, right? Because they got to during the January Direct, they're going to have to announce the rest of the Final Fantasies are coming. So
as long as they're all in one package and there's other ones to play, I won't be disappointed. So,
well, they're all going to have the music bug. They are not going to be in one package. They're going to be separate games, and they're going to be $30.
You gotta think positively, Jordan. You gotta think positively.
No, I'm realistic.
All right. Well, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see everyone again next week.
Yeah, it was fun. Bye.
Later.
Bye.